In this unusual retreat weekend, in which we have been in a retreat mode, very much in the Dharma, but we have also been focused on one aspect of a human experience, which is changes and transitions. Yesterday was primarily external, this morning was primarily internal. Now I want to have us briefly focus on a change and transition that you are choosing to make for yourself. It could be external, or it could be internal, or it could be a combination of both, but that which you are choosing to make a change, and you're needing to do it well. You're needing to gain some mastery in how to make this change, acquire this skill, learn to live in this new, to learn to live by yourself, or to learn right speech, or better, just learning how to better communicate, or whatever it is you're learning. It could be a skill, it could be an attitude. This would apply in some way to every situation. We're on the same page? So I'm going to be referencing this little book, which this version of it cost $11. It used to cost $5.95 by my dear, beloved, and now departed friend, George Leonard. George was an Aikido sensei. He taught Aikido for a number of years. He was also a wonderful journalist and was at one time the president of the AHP, American Humanistic Psychology Association. And he was a person who embodied saying yes to life. I was in awe of this. Just in awe. I love that. Mastery. And he created this course that's called The Life We're Given, and there's all these people all around the world do this course and all that. You can look him up. You can Google him on your own. We don't have to do that. But this saying yes to life, he was always wanting to learn about how to better relate to life. He was not Buddhist, not particularly interested in meditation, although he would meditate some. And when I would teach with him, he would indulge me in having us meditate more and all. And we had a really wonderful relationship. And I first heard of him when I was in college. And he published a book called Education in Ecstasy. And for those of us who were interested in breaking the modality, which is unfortunately to a large degree still in place, about this downloading, this front load, download, you know, one thing, and how people learn, he was really striking a revolutionary tone with that. And so then when I was at Esquire some 10 years later, he was out at Princeton University giving a talk, and I got to meet him, and we became instant friends. And that was probably in 1980 or something, and then so we had 30 years of friendship, and I also got to study Aikido under him. And he uses Aikido as his reference in here, but this is a marvelous little book. I'm not trying to sell, he's gone, so I'm not trying to sell his books. I am sharing my enthusiasm for the use of this for your purposes. So like a friend of mine was auditioning for the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, and she was in New York, and there's these famous great coaches, and so she takes her cello and goes in to have a lesson with this person, and so they're doing their lesson, preparing for this, and he says, you know, He says, there's this one book that I tell my students that would really help them in terms of if they really want to play at their utmost level in an orchestra. And gave her a copy of Mastery, which is a book that uses Aikido as its basis. So that's, and there's many other little stories like that. He says in this, and this is the, so we are, he's generously sharing with us this moment of what he learned. And he describes mastery as a long-term journey. And we certainly in Buddhism look at it as the gradual path. Sometimes there's moments when it moves fast on the gradual path, but it's the gradual path. And there are implications from it being a long-term journey. The first is that if we don't learn to love practice, we're in real trouble. If we engage in our spiritual life with attachment to results, we're going to get frustrated. We will actually develop a kind of sense of failure, of inadequacy. We can even develop a learned helplessness, because much of the time, he says, and has certainly been my experience, much of the time on the path is the plateau. You don't feel as though you're going anywhere particularly. And so what he taught, and I heard him say this better than anybody, is the joy of practice, learning to love the plateau, to take joy in the practice, not in the result. This is very, very Buddhist, despite him not being a Buddhist.
He was a Buddha.
He was a Buddha. There you go. Very good. Very good. He wouldn't mind that. He wouldn't mind that at all. That he was a Buddha, not a Buddhist. And so you can look at yourself honestly here right now. Have you really oriented towards the plateau? Do you orient towards learning to love practice? Or are you really just going for that result? One way to understand loving practice is it's this moment. It's this moment. And so the result's not here right now, because it's not here right now, but you're loving this moment. You're loving the practice that you're relating to this moment with intention, with all of the Eightfold Path in this moment. And that's the purpose, that's the meaning, that's the satisfaction, because right in this moment you're relating to the path. It's complete in itself. It doesn't need a result. In one sense, that's radical. In another sense, it really makes so much sense. It's almost a tautology, since that's what's available to us anyway. When we get started, we often bring with it, from having read or heard others talk, that we think that the path is a path of endless climaxes. There's this peak moment. Then there's this peak moment. Then there's this peak moment. This peak moment. It's not that way for very long for most people. It can start out that way, or it can be that way at various points along the way. But in an overall manner, it's not that way. Some of you read in Dancing with Life, when the Dalai Lama was speaking at Spirit Rock, we had him. He'd been teaching teachers in all the yamas, but we had him in a private session for the staff at Spirit Rock and the volunteers and Spirit Rock teachers. And someone stood up and said, "You know, Your Holiness, I've been practicing 10 years, and you know, sometimes I get so, or 5 years, whatever it was. I'm rushing here right now, so I'm not sure of my numbers here. I don't feel as though I'm going anywhere in my practice. What do you do? What do I do when I feel this way? What am I supposed to do?" And, you know, he was describing a moment on the plateau, right? So the whole room gets totally quiet. I mean, really. because, I mean, this is all practitioners, so we could really be quiet. And everybody wanted to know what the Dalai Lama was going to say about this. What wisdom? Because, of course, all of the teachers are imagining immediately we were going to say whatever he said, as well as take it for ourselves. And he said, you know, this, and it was quite a long time, maybe like 2 or 3 minutes. He finally says, you know, I sometimes feel like that. He says, I will feel like I'm not getting anywhere in my practice. Now, this is a man who gets up at 3:30 in the morning to practice, you know, and practices 3 hours before he starts his day. And he said, but then I reflect back 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and I can see that there's been movement. So, the Dalai Lama knows how to love the plateau. In part, it is our ego that doesn't know how to love the plateau. And our naivete in thinking that the ego has to be fed in this way. There's other factors too. I'm not going to go into all the factors that contribute to our thinking we need this endless climax. We live in a society that promises endless climaxes. Has that really delivered that way for you? I don't think so. But it promises it. It promises it. The advertisements, you know, this happiness of this car, of this toothpaste, you know. I could get even more graphic. The things that it promises will be like some climax of happiness. And it's just, experientially, that's just not true. But to sell things, people promise that. And so we live in this culture and we celebrate people who seem to have a life of endless climaxes. You know, I knew a bunch of those people in New York and that world, actually around the country, but when I was in that role, but also in my life balance role, where I have all of these people come sit on my couch that, not our back comes sits on my couch, it's written up in the newspaper, but a fair number of them have written up in the newspaper. And I have not found anybody that's having a life of endless climaxes. That's not how they're experiencing their life. It can seem that way from outside, but that's not what they report. Now, maybe there's some other people that I don't meet because they're so busy having their next climax. But for the rest of us, we have the lives we have that we've known that we would assume that life is kind of like this till we know otherwise. We're open to it being otherwise, but right now, and so we move, we say, okay, this my orientation, my expectation is my enemy here. Because it's creating a deluded state. It's causing me to not appropriately, accurately appraise what is meaningful, what is satisfying in life. And life as I know it. It's not some speculative life I'm reading about in the paper or hearing in the ads, but life as I know it. And so we gradually learn to approach life as practice and to love it as practice, because we are relating to life from our deepest values. What more can we ask for? That we get everything we want? Does that seem to happen very much? So, I mean, you know, I mean, it's like it's so simple in one way, but so hard to kind of get our minds around this. No, we treat life as practice, and we love treating life as practice because that's a meaningful relationship to life. Rather than being a victim, rather than being a wanting, rather than being a running away. No, we just like to practice. That's what we're doing. We're just practicing. George describes three kinds of practitioners that don't last long on the path. The first type he names is the dabbler, who kind of gets in and sort of messes around. They don't really give themselves over. But because they're relaxed in a certain way, they get some progress initially, and then it planes out. And then when it's planed out, all of the energy, all the attention goes away from it, straight down. Should draw this on the whiteboard for you. But so there's an immediate cutoff because the dabbler quits. That's why they dabble. They dabble here, they dabble there. I sometimes refer to that as tire kickers. You know, they go in and they go around or, you know, they won't even take a test drive in some instances. They don't do it long enough to have a real test drive. Is this something I really want to give myself time for? They just dabble around a little bit and off they go to the next thing. We've all done that. We're all, so don't go around feeling as though you're special here. Then the next type is the obsessive. And the obsessive type gets everything right, and so they move along. It takes them a while to kind of get everything lined up for there to be any sense of progress. And then they make some progress, but the obsession then starts to interfere. And there's this period of their obsessiveness because they're obsessed with making some progress that it doesn't. They're really trying hard, but they are their own worst enemy. You know when you've been that? You know, in your own practice? Many people have talked about this, about too much tension, too much efforting in practice. This is why, in part, I was doing this meditation about the awareness and all. Because when you rest back in the awareness, it balances out this kind of push in practice, this tension around being mindful. And so they will have a period of time when there's some real growth, George says, and then it starts to fall down, and then they keep trying really hard, and so they'll have these little, ever smaller amounts of progress, and then they just quit because they get frustrated because they're not being rewarded for their obsessiveness. And then the third type that he describes is the hacker. And the hacker, you know what a hacker is. They just sort of, they don't really learn the basics at all. They just go in and kind of, they've already got some skills from somewhere or another, so they just kind of hack their way around through something. A lot of different athletes would come into Aikido, people who are really good in some other sports or some other kind of activity, and not make it in Aikido. Because they did not want to learn the essentials. They considered themselves beyond the basics. And they just wouldn't learn the basics. So they would never learn that simple blend. And it seems, you know, it's done over and over and over again. So I understand why that feeling to it. But if you can't do the basic blend, no matter how strong you are, how quick you are, sooner or later, you just can't do it. It does not work out. You don't know how to do it. So a hacker can have mess around for a while and really make some progress, and then fall into the plateau. But then, because they haven't learned the plateau can't sustain itself because they don't really know how to practice. So then it all drops away. Then they have to start all over again, and it sort of does the same thing over and over again. And they may make a little, so they get to this plateau and this plateau, but it's not sustaining. They can't keep going because they won't learn the basics. So in our world, learning mindfulness, learning how to find a relaxed attention mindfulness, I would consider to be fundamental. That a mindfulness that works for you, not too tight, not too loose, as the Buddha said, mindfulness. That would be, the hacker wouldn't bother with that. And likewise, in terms of learning some form of the metta or one of the Brahmaviharas, metta or compassion that you can go to, of really developing some degree of equanimity, some degree, having some understanding of it, having some understanding of the four foundations of mindfulness. Some of these lists, the Four Noble Truths, you're learning the fundamentals because it's the fundamentals that will take you all the way. All of these spiffy insights are terrific, but those spiffy insights are just the fundamentals in their mature form. They're not different than the fundamentals as I would understand them, as my teacher teaches it. So you may have a different view, and that's fine. So we can watch ourselves when we're being a hacker or being an obsessive or being a dabbler. And to get more information on this, you can look at the book or something. The He stressed in Mastery the importance of five things. One was instruction, of having a teacher or a mentor or some basis of gaining knowledge. You got to have some amount of knowledge. You don't know all this for yourself. Even the Buddha had two teachers. Even the Buddha had five companions that he practiced with for years. So his final enlightenment was on his own, but he got there through an interpersonal process. So this having some basis of getting knowledge, and then secondly, of this real commitment to practice, which involves starting over. Starting over in terms that you stop practicing for a week or 2 weeks or 3 months. Sooner or later you go, no, I do care about this, and you start over. Just as you start over with one breath when you've lost it in a practice when you're doing the breath, following the breath. So this commitment to this continual development, not just as the formal practice, but practicing mindfulness in daily life, so that there's this totality, this 360 of commitment, as I would hold it. And then third is the surrender, as I did this morning, that you surrender to the how it is, that it's often boring, that it's often frustration, that there's nothing special, there's nothing to be clung to, that you're not accomplishing anything that you can see right now. You surrender all of this preference. You surrender your idea of yourself as to that you were supposed to be really good at this, or at least be average. You know, maybe you're not average at this. You just surrender everything that comes up and that's in the way of practice. You just surrender. Doesn't mean that you're blind in terms of practice. You use discernment, like, well, is this a good teacher to be studying with? Does this practice suit me? You have all of that sort of thing, and partially you get that by practicing and finding out for yourself. But you surrender all of your, it's supposed to be a certain way. And then the fourth thing is this intentionality, the way I have taught it so much this weekend, and to include the cultivation of the imaginative possible, where we over and over again work towards the moment where this new level of practice becomes possible. We imagine it possible. I can remember when I first sat for 3 hours, and I had this moment when I realized, you know, I don't think I have to get up. And I sat with huge amounts of body pain. I mean, I tell people not to sit with that much pain that I sat with. But I there was just this moment when I realized I don't have to get up. That it's all a story that I have to get up because of this pain, that I have to move. I don't have to move. I didn't. In that moment, I knew that. That it was maybe true, because maybe I was deluded, right? The pain was making me deluded. But in that moment, I knew it might be possible that I could just sit till something else was ready to move, and it was not based on my body. Huge difference. So, the sitting 3 hours is not the measurement, by the way. That's just an example to help you. And then the fifth thing that he offers in terms of mastery is that to work with your edge in some way. That if there's not any kind of edge to your practice, you'll tend to drift off. That's a whole discussion that I might have with you when I come back next time. We could have maybe a potpourri of topics, because when I teach working with the edge, I teach it. Don't work with the edge of the edge. Come back from the edge of the edge. Because if you work on the edge of the edge, you're going to fall off too many times. And you're going to fall too dramatically off sooner or later. So staying at the edge of the edge all the time is not sustainable. It's not long-term practice, as I have understood long-term practice for myself and others. The extreme asceticism would be staying at the edge of the edge, which the Buddha abandoned. So that we don't stay at the edge of the edge. There's a couple personality types that are particularly drawn to being at the edge of the edge, and I understand that and been there, done that. But it can again have this spurt in the moment, but it's not sustainable. You can't even stay on the plateau. You crash back down. I run into this all the time on retreats with people who are determined to be on the edge of the edge, and just have to wait for them to learn. So these five, to not be anywhere near the edge doesn't bring you. You need the interest. You need that adrenaline kicking in. All of the chemicals of being somewhere around the edge, some part of the time. So for the edge for you might be to take time you don't think you have. That's edgy. You don't think that your practice is good enough to take that time, and you take it anyway. Or for you, it might be taking on right speech in a certain situation, or it might be this surrendering some piece of your naive innocence. That's your edge. But you don't go around, like if you're surrendering your naive innocence, you wouldn't go tell all of your family members you were doing this. You would just do it yourself. That's staying on the edge, but not the edge of the edge. You see? So the last thing to say about this is that one of the challenges that George isolates so well is the challenge of homeostasis. Homeostasis is the tendency of any system to come back to its form when there's a disruption. We, in general, are for this. So the homeostasis is how your body gets back to being itself when you've torn it or broken it or whatever. The system it's got a form. It tends to go back to create its form. So when the floods come, it tends to go back to the formations before the flood, land does. And any environment will have any ecology has a certain homeostasis to it, you know, any kind of ecology, as I understand it. And it's very difficult to establish a new set point. We know this in weight loss. We know this in performance, athletic performance, and all of these different ways. It's difficult to establish a new set point. So it's hard to get to that plateau and stay there. So we may think nothing's happening, but if we're staying on the plateau, that's fantastic that we haven't crashed all the way back down. That is the challenge of homeostasis. So you make some your practice gets some vitality to it, and it's been there for a month or 2 days, and then you start to lose it. That would be a homeostatic effect. Your old patterns of mind, your old habits of getting up in the morning and having your coffee and not sitting, you tend to go back to your old behavioral patterns rather than to stay with what you've developed in terms of your practice. It's a natural thing. It is not making any comment about your character. This is the nature. This is nature, not your character. It's the nature of human beings. It's the nature of any system. It's not about your character. You're not specially awful in any way. So there are many more things to be said about all this, but I wanted to include this in our time together to point in a different way to working with our practice, and maybe it's pointed to you. We have lots of wonderful ways we talk about working with practice and the way we traditionally teach. Really wonderful, wonderful ways. But maybe this more generalized approach will be of help to some of you. And I would particularly have you remember about the plateau, learning to love the plateau, and finding joy in practice, and that you're always dealing with homeostasis. And that if you remember those things, then, because then you can feel great about yourself in being able to just sit the 20 minutes or whatever it is, you know, that you haven't gone further. So you just keep sitting, and sooner or later, something will happen. One of the things that's, you know, we think we hit this burst where things get really better, and we think it happened like that, or in this one retreat, or this one day, or this one sit. So much underneath change. So much purification. So much creating the right conditions. So it's, you know, you're an overnight success that took years to make. knowing that gives dignity. I've used this word advisedly 3 or 4 times in this weekend. It gives dignity to our practice. You see, and that dignity is its own reward. That's part of being, when we're loving the practice, when we're committed to the practice, the self-respect, that's just the best word, this dignity that is palpable to us and to others just starts to come. It's so more available, in my experience, to students than students understand, because they have these big notions about getting somewhere, and they miss the they don't, here's all this low-hanging fruit, in effect, and they're trying to, you know, pick the apple off the top of the tree without the nourishment, without having the patience of learning how to climb this limb and that limb. And so I have a certain amount of passion for this, for that reason. You know, I don't quite know what to do here, because I wanted to get this in. I owe the fourth group our session. And so I guess what I would have you do, we're going to do a short walk, and I'll do the best I can with the fourth group. And in this walk, I would like you to think of yourself as actually walking the path of practice, so that each step you take is a step in practice, that you're stepping into this moment with presence. You're just practicing being present. Sometimes you will be present, sometimes you won't. But your intention is unswerving. Even if you don't remember it, when you come back to it, confirm for yourself that you're intending to be awake in this step, so that you know what this step feels like. The step when the foot's coming down, when the foot's coming up, however speed you're walking, what you could notice, what you could be present for at the speed you're walking. That you're practicing being aligned with your intention.